Nationalist with Dr. Matthew Raphael Joseph.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another edition of the Orthodox Nationalist. Today, we're dealing with a topic that makes some people uncomfortable. When I was in graduate school, I dealt with the question of the sexual revolution through the work of E. Michael Jones. Jones is one of the central figures of my intellectual development. When I was in grad school, I think my mind was rescued by in toward the more activist realm, E. Michael Jones and Michael Hoffman. And you square that with some of the academic stuff that I was doing, you know, full time there, and I was saved from the, you know, mainstream. I was asked recently what my red pill was, so to speak, and I was kind of born and raised in a funeral home. That's kind of, you know, automatically born into it. You know, that's crazy enough. But it was the Buchanan campaign of 1992, and it was therefore the social issues. There were things like abortion and the fags, and those were the main issues for me. The economic stuff, all this stuff's very important, and in fact, it's central to the modern world. Economics is first and foremost the center of the modern world. It's inverted the natural order of things. Spiritual values either denied to exist or are completely subservient to the material world. But E. Michael Jones had spent a lot of time. He doesn't do much of it anymore. But for many, many years, he was concerned that liberalism is, as Alexander Dugin and so many others have argued, is a deeply totalitarian system. The fact that the government is not involved in it, except indirectly, may enforce certain things, but it doesn't do the bulk of the work. The state is more or less a passive and very clumsy actor, far more powerful, far more invasive, far more invidious, far more thorough than the state ever could be, are conglomerates of capital. In the ancient world, medieval world, early modern period, there was no such entity as what we call today the conglomerate, especially the media conglomerate. That's something that makes modernity and postmodernity completely different from any other period in history. The existence of this mass media, controlled by a tiny handful of people, following an identical ideological line, is something that makes this era completely unique, that no era can come close to it. Someone like me, and I was born in 1971, I was born and raised throughout the very flowering and absolute dominance of the sexual revolution. Most of my listeners, unless they're very, very elderly, have been hardwired into its mentality. That these carnal desires, whether it be sex or money or power, or by the feeling for men, women hold the key to their self-esteem. And that money and these other things are a gateway to that. And this is also Jones's idea, that throughout the 19th and 20th century, revolutionaries realized something about socialism, and that is that, or even liberalism for that matter, is that it enshrines desire. Whether it be the desire of the working class to gain its proper share of the economic pie, or the individual entrepreneur not only demanding that he have his ability to dominate in the civil world, but also once he's successful in that world to be able to translate that into political power. And the liberal revolution is, in essence, to put it simply, when merchants, wealthy classes, whether they produce anything or not, believing that success in that realm means that they should have control over the society as a whole. The French Revolution to put it very simply, you had powerful classes, whether they be titled or not, you know, noble classes or not, who had discovered the power of money and what it was like to be able to buy and sell government titles, for example, which is very important for the French state to raise money in difficult times. Selling offices was extremely important, but everything was becoming monetary. The state was growing in power. The state was growing in power because there were a growing class, a very powerful moneyed interest to draw from. But they're not going to lend the state money. They're not going to be the bankers of the state without demanding a share in power. One thing that's essential to modernity is deceit. The Medicis took over and created the Renaissance in Florence. You know, the Renaissance in northern Italy is essentially the creation of one family. It's the means whereby the Medici banking clan disguised their rule over North Italy. And when they captured the papacy, they put to line, of course, the claims of the Catholic Church, which always is something that Michael Hoffman has recently been stressing, that alchemical revolutionary clan dominated the politics of North and Central Italy, and hence much of the Southern European world for a long time. But banking was non-productive. Mass society was just developing. When traditional society is divided into orders. You know, we believe in class rule, but that class has nothing to do with income. That class has to do with temperament and function and virtue. Mass society is the opposite of medieval society. Mass society only exists in the modern era, where in the medieval mentality, at its best, each human being was part of an order, part of a class. These classes were, in theory, equal, at least in the sense that they were equally necessary to the running of any society. There was no such thing as a centralized state. There was no such thing as a centralized corporation. Nothing like that existed. That's strictly a modern idea. But the reason you didn't have much suicide and much mental illness in the ancient medieval world was this idea. Everyone belonged to a corporation, to a class that had specific responsibilities, but also very specific benefits as well. Whenever this balance was challenged, there you have political violence. But there was one group of people who didn't fit in any of that. One group of people that were always very shadowy, and that almost they acted because they didn't produce anything. They didn't belong to any particular corporation. And this was the moneylender, the businessman, the banker. Because they didn't produce anything, they manipulated wealth that others produced. They devised ways of making the infertile fertile through usury. This class was always shadowy, was always looked down on, and there was always this fear that money in the wrong hands can become so powerful as to overwhelm the balance of any society, no matter how just it might be. Thomas Hobbes, not an accident that he is writing during the English Renaissance, says that it doesn't matter how virtuous people are in any society. They could be the most wonderful people in the world, but when one person begins to build up their private fortune, when one person or one family begins to arm themselves, everyone else has to do that too. Everyone else has to respond. That's the problem. It doesn't matter how virtuous you are. All it takes is one person just need to dominate everybody else. And then at least in self-defense, everyone else has to adopt that mentality. And Thomas Hobbes is talking about something a bit more abstract than that, though. He's talking about the rise of, actually less abstract, something more concrete, something that he was seeing everywhere. And that this very shadowy group of people were rising up through the cracks. Everyone kind of knew that they were necessary at some level, but ultimately very destructive. Because they were outside of normal social channels, I mean, they didn't make anything. They exploited the work of others. They were often Jews. Now, let's be very careful. Jews in the medieval world were automatically considered Talmudists and rabbinic Jews. And then a bit later on, Kabbalist Jews. The Karaites were not considered Jews in the sense that medievals use the term. That's something that often gets forgotten. Karaites were not considered Jews in the invidious sense of the term. Jew was a bad term in that they were this shadowy element. But what made them different from everybody else was this Talmud. And this Talmud, of course, also giving birth to the Zohar and the and the pseudo-mystical elements of the Kabbalah. There were plenty of other small minority groups in Europe that were known as very good businessmen. Syrian Arabs, for example, and Armenians, just to name two. I don't recall campaigns of kicking them out of country after country after country, of these groups taking over entire societies and being so hated that they're hunted down in the streets, being used as scapegoats. Whatever the theory is, you had non-Christian. Remember, the Armenians were considered heretics, so they were out of the picture. And Syrians were either sometimes that they're actually Jews, but Syrians could also be Muslims or Monophysites. These people were also outside of the mainstream, were also excellent businessmen, and yet didn't have the reputation and weren't kicked out of society after society like the Talmudic Jews were. So when the medieval and early modern writer uses the word Jew, he is not referring to the Karaites. The Karaites, for all their problems, are an honorable group of people. They're not Jews in the sense we normally use the word. The Khazar elite adopted the Jewish religion because of the Talmud, because it justified the slave trade that they were already making a lot of money in. It provided a legal structure that allowed a ruling class to act like it's following the law, but not really. It was it was never a religion. Judaism is not a religion, has never been. It's far more an ethnic connection. Most Jews today are atheists. But it is this connection to the repairing of the world. It is, as E. Michael Jones will say, the rejection of logos, which means the rejection of the ultimate purpose in the world around them. And therefore, that purpose has to be given by them. This is the foundation of industry. This is the foundation of the empiric scientific revolution, which preceded it. The scientific revolution in and of itself wasn't all that interesting, except for this explosion of silver coming in from the New World, starting in the very early Renaissance, and then the growing colonies of the Netherlands and Portugal, where Jewish merchants played a huge role. All of a sudden, a massive amount of capital is flooding into early modern Europe. And when that's attached to the scientific mentality, with this rise of the Talmudic merchant idea, you had a very, very different, very perverse society that we call modernity, based on nominalism. And when you remove all meaning, all logos from the world around you, including yourself, and then claim the world around you is therefore dead, it has no intrinsic meaning, that would automatically mean that you, or whoever has power, gives it meaning. Without that, industrialism doesn't make any sense. That was an idea considered so perverse that no society ever held to it. No society ever viewed the world around them as just this dead entity and the conscience of the elite alone outside of it, and can, like a god, like a demiurge or an architect. Demiurge and architect are really considered the same thing in an arcane kind of a way. The demiurge can then produce meaning, can manipulate language. The point of all of this is that this merchant class had to rule by deceit. It could never rule open. The problem is that monarchies are based on the fundamental virtue that whatever power they happen to have, and they didn't see power as coercion, they saw power as authority. Only the modern American believes power is automatically this coercive force. They really meant authority in the sense of I'm an authority on something. The point being that that whatever power they had an equal responsibility. Power is personalized. Monarchs hated bureaucracy because it created a new ruling class that stood in the way of between the monarch and the population and the orders. Only the English revolutionary started using that stupid, idiotic phrase, the people. That is the first reference during the beginning of the English Civil War, the reference that the English parliamentarians made, this new entity, this new political abstraction, the people. And it was a mystification. Prior to that, that doesn't make any sense. There are no masses unless society produced them. It's essentially a proletariat. a faceless mass. But the English Revolution is the first one to not look at society as grouped around orders or specific tasks and guilds, functions, classes, in the true sense of the word, but just as a faceless mass of a teeming mass of people with no real, as individuals, no real purpose. The individual, unless you are very wealthy, is meaningless in any society. One person, unless they're very powerful, very wealthy, can't change much. That's an undeniable fact. And especially today, where you're one of billions of people, where even very wealthy, powerful people can't get what they want all the time. The individual has no chance. Mankind, therefore, as a matter of nature, no society has not done this. This is a universal fact and therefore an aspect of human nature. Any society is divided up into functions. Your scholars and your clergy and your warriors and your government scribes, not bureaucrats yet, but scribes, those involved in the arts, builders, all the martial arts. And these develop, they're all essentially important, of course, agriculture, the peasantry, and all the crafts and all the professions. These have, all of them have an important role, an important contribution. So naturally, and this is how we think. You know, Bernard Bosanquet argued, the English Hegelian, post-Hegel Hegelian in England, that the traditional view of society is made up of classes and orders. It's exactly how the brain is organized. We don't really think in terms of individual words or individual ideas. We think of clusters of ideas, that things are connected. Colors are connected to shapes, and shapes are connected to emotions. And, you know, we think in terms of clusters. We never think of individual things. We're always thinking in terms of clusters of ideas, all closely connected around a specific theme, like an ecosystem would be in the natural world. Because the brain actually is organized in the same way that society is. This is a natural way that the individual can go from meaninglessness to having some purpose, and having a purpose that everyone knows is socially necessary, socially important, and that therefore, because of the organization, you want to call it a guild or a corporation, as Hegel does, has its own set of rules and standards. And those are extremely important because they come from practice. And this was the foundation of almost every society that ever existed. And a central rule was was almost non-existent. You know, bureaucracy almost didn't exist anywhere. There were a few exceptions to that, like Byzantium and China. But even there, they're tiny by comparison to just what a small town bureaucracy would be. And they were not standardized, and they were not routinized like they are today. The creation of the masses meant that society began to be seen as a machine rather than an organism. And that was deadly for the world. When you remove all purpose and essence and logos from the world around you, and all is just dead matter waiting for science to come and give it purpose and meaning according to the whims of the ruling class, when that's the case, the only thing you see around you is cause and effect. This is the only constant universal, I think, and even there, the nominalist struggles with the idea of cause and effect because it is a universal. But it is very hard to see. We don't really see cause and effect, as Hume would say. We just see states that exist in succession. Without getting too, you know, if Hume, that could be exaggerated. Lots of Hume's ideas have been exaggerated over the years. But the point I'm trying to make with all of this, the growth of modernity, the growth of secrecy, rule by deception, the inversion of all things, the material rules the ideal rather than the other way around. And that merchant class, seen as negative, as destructive, as based around the passions rather than reason, comes to rule. But because it functions in such a way, it has to rule by deceit. So the Medici's created the notion that it rules behind the scenes, while the outward window dressing of the Italian Republic in these areas continue to function as normal. What people didn't realize is that this functioning was secretly at the whim of this new elite. And so the Medici bankers created and financed this explosion of alchemy, what they call Neoplatonic studies. It's nothing to do with Plato. It is about the myth of the metals, you know, gold people and silver people and bronze people being different orders of society, given new meaning by the new leaders. The enlightened person has nothing to do with the enlightened person of medieval Christianity, whether East or West. They give them new meanings. You know, gold and the sun has always been masculine and rational. Whether you be think in terms of Apollo or in terms of Saint Dionysius or the Areopagite, it's really the same idea. You know, Christ came and he completed these forms, but didn't eliminate them. He just showed them how they fit into a much broader intuitive scheme of the cosmos. The question is here that the Medici clan comes to Italy and they start something brand new, a revolutionary movement based around scientific alchemy, where a society seems to function one way in the old Republican system, but in reality, those who control the money are controlling everything from behind the scenes. This is the absolute focus of everything in the Renaissance. It was overwhelmingly negative in that sense. Politically speaking, it was an absolute disaster for Western societies because this was now institutionalized. Machiavelli made his career both warning us about this and advocating this. Machiavelli made the same argument that Hobbes did, in essence. It doesn't matter how virtuous you are. If one person gains power at your expense, if one person seems hell-bent on becoming very powerful, unless you want to be swallowed up in that, you need to react, and therefore you need to arm yourself as well. Arm yourself in the broad sense of the term. Now, our topic is something that's bothered me for a long time. We're talking about this movement of modernity from the Renaissance in Italy, and then it moved to Northern Europe, Holland, and England. And that leads to the scientific revolution, the growth of these colonies, especially in the New World, and this massive influx of silver, the growth of the slave trade, the colonial empire, and this is where the influx of capital came to create industry. The creation of industry requires such a massive and sudden and rapid influx of capital that naturally no society could ever produce it. No state could ever be that powerful to mobilize that tightly to create enough excess, enough a surplus production to create industry, especially on the scale that was later to develop in the late 18th century. It needed to come from a revolutionary ideology. It needed to come from overseas colonies. It needed to come from things like the slave trade, and especially this explosion of precious metals, especially silver, coming in from the New World. But that even would not be sufficient unless you have a guiding ideology. And E. Michael Jones had always made the claim that this ideology at root was sexual. It was sexual because ultimately it was about desire. What the Renaissance and the modern world, the Enlightenment did, is to enshrine desire and passion as the root of everything. Not just that it simply is the governing force in the world, but that it should be, and there's nothing wrong with that. So the Marquis de Sade, as Jones spends a lot of time on, connected political revolution to sexual control. That liberalism, coming from this pedigree, it's not just an ideology that came from nowhere, this is where it came from. The concept was a desire for power, the desire for money, desire for success, for good reputation, for sexual satisfaction, are all pretty much the same thing. In a society now dedicated to cause and effect and mechanism, where we're just seen now as machines, there really is no more moral place to stand to question traditional mores in terms of family life. Peter the Great, as my listeners know, through the Masonic lodges, who were the local cells of this movement throughout the world, brought this into Russia and created a revolution. And part of that revolution, at least among the ruling classes, was to remove the capital from the very traditional, very religious Moscow and bring it to the floating city of St. Petersburg. It was done according to the Masonic order on the bodies of the traditional, literally on the corpse of traditional Russia, which are the Cossacks, killed by the thousands in forced labor, very much like Solomon, creating his new temple, the floating city, as it was called, because it was a conquest of nature. It was not just it didn't work with nature, it sought to fight it and subdue it. It was deliberately done in a very, very harsh climate, showing the victory of elite reason over everything else, the domination of dead matter and everything around it. And it created two Russias. It created the Petersburg Russia, which was foreign. I mean, much of the time, the Masons poured into Russia. And even without that, a huge foreign influx from Germany and Holland and elsewhere came and became a new ruling class within Russian society. And pretty soon, the elite weren't speaking Russian anymore. In the 18th century, it was split between German and French. Russian was for peasants. So the ethnic connection that existed in Muscovite Russia, which is far more egalitarian than what came later, was broken entirely. And now you had two different societies. Maybe you're speaking two different languages. You read Dostoevsky and Pushkin, and they're always making fun of how the elite are trying to speak, especially the provincial elite, trying to speak French, and they sound like idiots, because they don't really know why. This is what the elite in Petersburg do. The last thing they wanted to speak was Russian. But that came in the 19th century. In Russian history, in Orthodox history, everything comes from the Petrine epoch. The good news, of course, is that the Orthodox world continued to exist. My listeners are well aware. Peter purged the church, purged the society, destroyed monasticism. There were a handful of monks left in Russia at the time of his death. There were refugees. The Russian population had fallen substantially. Bishops were completely subservient to him and were created by him. And good bishops had been murdered or imprisoned or tortured to death or were tortured into submission in every major city. His people were running things. And you had a materialist, alchemist, very much very close to the order that came out of northern Italy, and that is Fyodor Prokopovich. And so this is kind of a long introduction into the idea of the sexual revolution in pre-revolutionary Russia. Now, when we say pre-revolution, we're really referring to the Bolshevik Revolution. We can also be referring to the 1905-06 Revolution. It was really created by the press, irresponsibly, claiming that defeat, so to speak, in the Japanese War meant that Russian society had to be reformed. Well, there was no defeat in the Japanese War. The British government was financing Japan. British sailors were on those ships. British sailors and elites were everywhere in Japan. Japan was mobilized, according to them, 100%. At Portsmouth, New Hampshire, at the peace conference, Japan said, "We are completely and absolutely exhausted." And yet Russia was mobilized maybe 5%, 10% at the most. Problem with the Japanese War was that it was many time zones away. It was thousands of miles away. It's such a huge area. There was one railroad supplying the far eastern ports. It was a very difficult war for Russia to fight. She was fighting at 2-3% capacity at best at that part of the world. They were at such a disadvantage. And Japan, with tremendous money from the Rothschild family, backing the Japanese, as always, because the British elites had one enemy, and that was Russia. And the sexual revolution was a way to weaken the Russian ruling class. Now, you find this in Dostoevsky's novel, A Raw Youth. Sometimes it gets translated as a teenager or the adolescent or something like that. It's something to do with a young, determined, but not well-informed boy. Arkady Dolgorky is the main character, and he was a symbol of this era. We're talking about the 1870s here. Serfdom had been overthrown. Nicholas I had died. The press, just like it did in 1905, invented a whole myth that because there was a defeat in Crimea, and with the same problem there as you had in Japan, therefore Russia is horrible and we need to follow all liberal methods. If you ever read the Russian press throughout its history, when the Tsars ruled, you realize that it was absolutely absurd. There was no real civic debate in the press. This was a tightly controlled group of urban elites having no connection with Russia whatsoever, being disproportionately Jewish, and not being under, most certainly not being under state control. Nicholas I would have loved for it to be under state control, but he was stymied at every turn. He was one man facing now a growing bureaucracy and a huge country and a huge empire, and he had very limited power, as he always complained about. A monarch is only as powerful as his ruling class, and his ruling class was at war with him. The Royal Youth was about what happens when the Decembrist mentality takes over the elite in society. It's not an accident that Dostoevsky has this kid desire to be a Rothschild. That's what he says. This is what I want to become. He was a nihilist. Now, a nihilist in Russia, it didn't mean nothing. It just meant nothing of substance. The nihilist movement in Russia was kind of scientific in that it only recognized cause and effect. Everything was a machine. And it was positivist in its general scientific approach. That's what a nihilist was in Russia. They weren't anarchists specifically. They were positivists. They were nominalists. To be a nominalist was to be a nihilist. And it was true then, and it's true now. But sometimes we read people who don't really know what they're talking about. They talk about nihilism like it was something special. They don't realize that they're nihilists. Because a nihilist was somebody who rejected. Let's put it this way. Dostoevsky is defining a nihilist here. And in this character, this deformed, just disaster of a kid coming out of all of this destruction, both of Western and Eastern society, as a nihilist, in that there is no meaning to life, there's no meaning to the outside world, to creation at all. That's at the foundation of nominalism. Nominalism is essential for the revolutionary, any kind of revolutionary idea, whether it be the Petrine Masonic Revolution, which took the entire 18th century, the Revolution of 1905, as I mentioned, and the Revolution, of course, as we all know, 1918. And then we could say with a tremendous degree of accuracy, the revolution of the early 1990s. And all of these revolutions are very similar in that they were completely destructive. Almost all of them gave nothing very positive. Somehow this nihilism meant freedom to some people. The intellectual class, especially at the local level, saw freedom as being enslaved to blind cause and effect. Now you don't figure the logic that this is exactly how these people twisted words, and how the Russian language worked itself out this way. Arkady Dologorky is to be condemned in essence. The point of this book, and very few people read this anymore, it's one of his major novels. And more work has to be done on it. This is extremely applicable to today, the revolution, whether it be 1918 or 1991. One of the obsessions, unfortunately a sin that Dostoevsky fell into, was destructive gambling. Russian Orthodox serfs were worked to an early grave in the Petrine system so that elites couldn't go gamble in Western Europe. This did not happen in Muscovite Russia. There is no remote connection between that mentality and the Muscovite mentality. You had a far greater equality between legitimate nobles, military servitors on the one hand, and the peasants on the other. Here, they're not even speaking the same language. They don't live in the same places. They're two different nations. They're not even, one is barely human. The other is this cipher, this attempt to be Western. The book is really about reconciling materialism to freedom. He can't get around this stupidity that the entire modern world is based on, that freedom somehow is identical with accepting these passionate drives in an entire global, inescapable realm of cause and effect. We are just cogs in a machine, and that is freedom. This is what the nihilists were preaching. This is what the press was preaching at the time. This is ultimately the cognitive dissonance of kids like Arcady growing up in the 1870s, seeing the power that the Rothschilds have. They don't really do anything. They don't make anything. It's all deceit. It's all gambling. Dostoevsky, another great book which I strongly recommend, The Gambler, which has to be read very slowly. Most people don't get it. What he's really talking about is usury. He's talking about the idea that money made in a non-productive and even destructive way like gambling is considered your property in the exact same way that money gained through legitimate building, enterprise, hard work. When you have an abstract property right, it says that those two things are the same. We may have different attitudes towards them, but ultimately, at the end of the day, the concept of property with the money, you gain money and profit and power through gambling, which is identical to things like, you know, betting on currencies and things like that, which Rothschilds did, started by the Medicis many centuries earlier. That money is equally yours and is as much morally yours as money made legitimately. The big difference in what Dostoevsky is worried about here, and what he's very, as an addict of gambling himself, and actually broke him, he lost all of his money this way, and it was, you know, everyone has a sin, you know, everyone has a thing, was that those who were following the nihilistic Rothschild approach could make far more money and therefore have far more power and even social respect than those who actually worked hard and produced something of value. The farmer who worked very hard and produced high-quality crops and high-quality goods and craftsmen, these people could never reach, even remotely, could not even be a footnote in the financial life of even the lowliest servitor of the Rothschild family. So he's looking at this inversion of the world. He doesn't know what to do. He knows it's wrong. He knows that freedom can't be cause and effect. That's the very negation of freedom. But the minute you say that we're above cause and effect, you're talking about the spiritual realm. Well, he can't say that. The minute a nihilist starts talking about a spirit, he's no longer a nihilist. Tell me what that spirit is, where it comes from, what consciousness is. It can't be material. Cause and effect is the very opposite of freedom. It's the exact opposite of what freedom is. Ultimately, at the end of the novel, chaos results from this cognitive dissonance. He's trying to become a Rothschild, and he's destroying himself in the process. Only chaos results. And ultimately, Arcady has to admit that only through purity can any kind of happiness be maintained. That when you see the world, it doesn't matter how much money you have, when you see no purpose and everything as a machine, and you, it doesn't matter what kind of rewards you get, you're just as much a cog in that machine as any peasant is. But when this was brought into Russia, and Dostoevsky he dedicated his whole career to exposing this and mocking this, a raw youth is totally unread, and it's a shame. This is not on that book. I'm going to do this some other time. But it just goes to show the mentality that the Rothschild idea was everywhere in Russia. That when you do the wrong thing, when you pretend that the world is this prison of cause and effect, you can, in imitating that mentality, gain tremendous wealth and tremendous power, where virtuous hard work will never get you there. This is why Dostoevsky had this almost metaphysical obsession with gambling, because it was no different than the economy that was now, that had gotten started put into place in Europe anyway, by the Medici clan, which created the Renaissance, and the kind of the currency speculation that we see today. The amount of money that a George Soros or that Goldman Sachs can make in one transaction that people are not even aware exists is hundreds of yearly salaries of actual good workers that make things that we all need. It's complete perversion and complete inversion. But this is a direct result of believing that the world around you has no purpose, that everything is cause and effect, and essentially nothing has meaning except what you're told. That the elite decide what reality is. Not just what's good, bad, true and false. They decide what's real and what is not. They decide what's sane and what's insane. This is very dangerous. Wherever you get this mentality as well, man's society doesn't see orders, as we said before. It sees things as just individuals, meaningless, useless individuals, proletarians, useless eaters, as the elite like to say today. But when you eliminate orders and guilds and treat people as these powerless, harmless individuals, well, why should there be differences in men and women? Or in among races? Or among ethnic groups? You know, this is a justification for imperialism. Remember, the British Empire, at all points in its development, never ever used Christianity, whatever kind of weird, watered-down version they were using at any given time, as justification for this empire. It was not. Progress was. That they were the stronger power, that they were, they had redefined history in linear terms. They were bringing progress to the ignorant. They were bringing technology, roads, banking, currency. They thought they were the good guys here. It was progress. They were bringing modernity to these people. Their purpose was to smash all traditional forms of organization. That purpose is exactly the same today. But one of the results of that, the Wives of the Decembrists, it was a proto-feminist movement in Petrograd, in elite urban Russia. Remember, the Decembrists were... What they were trying to do, it was a Masonic order amongst elite military officers with strong funding from abroad. Each one of them was a member of a lodge to overthrow the monarchy and to create a Jacobin bloodbath. That was their purpose. The Northern Society and Southern Society, these were Masonic organizations that were following the mentality of the French Revolution. It was also some of the biggest names in the Russian aristocracy. I mean, this Wives of the Decembrists, Volonskaya, Trubetskaya, Nikova, Narishkina, Fonzavina, these were all, you go through these names, it's like a history book of the biggest Russian names in throughout our history. The same elites that revolted as the Decembrists in 1825, it was the same families that fought Boris Godunov. And installed the oligarch, never really a czar in any meaningful way, Vasily Shushkin, during the time of troubles in the early 17th century. The same clan installed Peter I and his Masonic clique in the late 17th century. And it ruled, as I've written elsewhere, as an oligarchical pagan cult throughout the 18th century. And now, the time of the, we're talking now between the Decembrist revolt, which failed, of course, and the death of Nicholas I. The span of his reign, sought the Jacobin Revolution in Russia. Remember, in Russian history, the upper reach of the nobility in the post-Petrine era were anything but conservative. Peter, the Masons under the Byron cult and all those around him, and then, of course, Catherine II completely purged the church, purged the upper classes, Pugachev and Razin, much previous to him, purged Russia of its best elements. And the ruling class, once it was freed from its service by Catherine II, meant that now it can rule, and absolutism, to the extent that it ever existed in Russia, was gone, because now freeing the nobility meant that they were a corporation that did not have to listen to the monarch, that were completely free from royal control, and that a constitution had finally been imposed on Russia. And it did what, you know, any constitution was supposed to do. Destroy the power of the monarch and divide that power among the ruling class that's left. That's nothing to do with peasants. They didn't care about peasants. They were owners of peasants. They didn't like serfdom because they wanted to be able to hire these peasants at pennies an hour, rather than having, you know, a commune to negotiate with, who had a guarantee of land. The free market for the Decembrists and for liberalism in Russia meant that they were kicked off the land. They completely rejected the idea of communes having control over the land, that all land should be bought and sold. This is what the Decembrists were all about. So yes, they were very much against serfdom, but American historians are so stupid that they don't realize that serfdom guaranteed the communal organization of serfs, It guaranteed land. It guaranteed a traditional structure far more democratic than anything that you have in America today. The destruction of that, if serfdom was abolished according to their rules, you would have nothing but a huge land market dominated by an oligarchy, and these peasants now working for far less. They would not be guaranteed anything. They would not have land at all. They would be a rural proletariat, and that was the ultimate purpose here. The Jacobin Revolution, where these elites, after the death of the Tsar and the killing of the king ritual, would be an oligarchy like no other. And what had begun in the English Revolution was perfected even greater in the French Revolution, continuing to be perfected in Russia, at least. And hopefully, according to the Jacobins, in 1825, it would be finally perfected in Russia. Well, it was perfected in 1918, and it's continuing to be perfected. It's continuing to grow, this revolutionary idea. It's the same root. It's the same concept. It's continuing to grow in sophistication. And one of the things that it's learned is that the state is not a usable vehicle. It's nice. I mean, we could use it to get rid of people we don't like, but it's not. It cannot in and of itself be the prime mover. Private corporations controlling how people think, that's far more important. Turn of the century, St. Petersburg, many of these very powerful families, they consecrated themselves to Dionysus, and they used the artificial crystal palace as their main symbol. They served as the epicenter of the rich and powerful in Petersburg. And the concept was to bring Paris, bring the Masonic idea of the Parisian manners to Russia. To be Parisian at the time was to be bohemian and revolutionary. The gypsies were often wildly romanticized because they were seen as libertine and non-Christian, were used to bring the Dionysian feelings to their apex while the vodka flowed. So this is like, you know, today a club where the pounding rhythm of the music gets people at absolute fever pitch. And then when they release male sexual urges, complain when it takes its natural route. The male sexual drive is one of the most powerful drives on the planet. It is one of the most obsessive. Men will do anything to satisfy. To allow that to be deliberately provoked, especially when alcohol is involved, is ludicrous. And yet, the system, not only today, but then, in the salons of St. Petersburg at the time, and it was deliberately non-Christian, and the use of the gypsy choirs was a way to have this non-Christian element, this pagan element, and the gypsies were seen as this free, wonderful people. This was the idle rich that Catherine II had freed from service. And these women who were, they were educated, but they were looking for some kind of ruler. They were looking for something. They had no real purpose anymore. And so they loved any real spiritualist or fortune teller that would flatter them. And usually it would just be some sort of sexual conquest. And the males, almost all deeply involved in Freemasonry and Jacobin politics. And the females, of course, as we all know, had other pastimes, as did the men. Revolution had a female caste in St. Petersburg. The women, as the traditional rulers of the home, were perverted. These westernized libertines wanted to revoke the old moral order. Their husbands wanted to do it politically, but the women wanted to do it privately and sexually. The wives of the Decembrists, especially the elite families, Trubetskoy and Volonsky, became centers around which the new left was created in Siberia. When the Decembrists were exiled under Nicholas I, the wives followed along. These weren't prisons out there. They were just kicked out of the area. Being sent to Siberia was meaningless. Now, later on, they actually had prisons and things like that. For the most part, being sent to Siberia was just getting kicked out of the country. But they followed along and created an entire libertine culture out there. And they created this called new Russian female character that you're going to find explode in 1918, pre-1918, 1925, in Soviet Union under Alexander Kollontai. Post-reform Russia destroyed the idea of woman. From the revolution of Peter I, the woman, like in any other revolutionary society that's ever existed, women became the object of male desire, and her worth was measured accordingly. Women loved it because when you release the male sex drive, men will do anything to get the approbation of females. So they get tremendous privileges if they look good enough, and they're willing to play along. They get a lot of privileges. They get money thrown at them. We know how easy attractive American women have it. All they have to do is sit there. And men will fall over each other, throwing money at them, sometimes literally throwing money at them. The elite in Russia, the highest level of the elite in St. Petersburg, led the way in total destruction of Russian manners and Christian customs. The slogan of this Wives of the Decembrists movement was freedom of the will outside prudence and decency. The consequences of Western capitalism made their way through this once traditional society. As capitalism continued to develop throughout Russia, a lot that hasn't really been studied much in English, and one of these things is called the Athenian Vespers. You find that certain poetic circles around the turn of the century, the Athenian Vespers were essentially orgies of different kinds. What they tried to do was recreate in their own imaginations the concept of sacred prostitution. The upper classes alone, though, created this bohemian lifestyle. And, of course, they all joined the socialist revolutionary, not fully understanding what socialism meant. But at least the Jewish elites in that movement were saying that, yeah, we'll let you, you know, continue to do all this stuff. Athenian Vespers was, this is what happens when an elite has no more purpose, has money and power and has control over the population, and yet has no real role in society. There were irrelevancies, and yet they still had control over the mass of the serfs. Dmitry Pisarev was one of the the most consistent of the nihilists. He spoke of the destruction of not just the Tsar, but in the destruction of the Tsar, it meant religion and morals in general. And people like Pisarev realized that the morality of the elite circles in Russia was very, very low. And it was no different than anywhere else, of course. The lower classes, as always, were very traditional, with old believers, having nothing to do with this official mentality. Pisarev writes the following, quote, "According to my convictions, a woman is free in body and spirit, I may dispose of it according to her discretion, without answering to anyone, even her husband. If a woman who can enjoy a life will not, there is no virtue. This behavior is a result of massive prejudice, which hamper pleasure and produce useless and imaginary difficulties. Life is beautiful, and we must use it. From this point of view, I look and find it fair that each person was guided by this same rule." End quote. This is the exact same nonsense and garbage that is promoted by university professors and ad campaigns and capitalists today. At her own discretion, as if the woman is in charge of fashion or this kind of morals or what men want to do with them. They have absolutely no control and no discretion. That's the entire point of this whole thing. It's a fraud. A woman who would not consent to that kind of lifestyle will be an outcast. So this fake freedom is just as ridiculous as trying to claim that liberty can be had in a world entirely made up of cause and effect and no breaking free of it. And you have the people like Chernyshevsky, the very famous leftist and materialist, who, of course, made free love part of the official creed. The idea, and Dostoevsky talks about this in The Possessed, the left revolutionaries use desire to control people. E. Michael Jones based the early part of his career around the idea that when the elites talk people into saying these pleasures can be had, and there won't be any consequences or anything, they are then freed from traditional constraints, except that there are consequences and they're expensive. And of course, the elite is there with all the solution. They will satisfy these passions for a fee, of course, and will make sure that every problem is cleaned up afterwards. What that really means is that the only people who can take advantage of this kind of thing are the elite themselves. Women were, of course, destroyed, as they're being destroyed now. They're objects because that's what the nihilist mind, the positivist mind, makes of them. Women are objectified as objects of male desire in the same way that men were objectified as objects in capitalist desire, whether it be in the army or in the on the factory floor. Everyone was an object. This was a problem. So then you had the rise of Emperor Alexander III, who was at war with this. Any impropriety in family relationships he wanted to crush. But he had realized at the end of the 18th century that even in the royal family itself, the nihilist creed had taken over. The grand dukes and brothers and cousins didn't consider it necessary to imitate the emperor in his pious life. They had mistresses, many of them were homosexuals. They had many illegitimate children, they had second lives, they had second families, and the press loved exposing this. You know, they loved, the press was very yellow at the time, and on the one hand, the elite loved it. This showed them how modern they were and how manly they were. On the other hand, it sold a lot of papers. But most importantly, it was the beginning of the decay of the mentality that would support monarchy and the church. The church, of course, had rebuilt itself after Catherine II. That is true. It was a long, very difficult road. A bishop were given total authority. They had no property. They were not permitted any property. All income went to the state. And instead of having property, the state would then put these people on, including priests, on state salaries. And the monasteries were cut in half. The idea by the turn of the century was that the Russian woman, except the peasant, of course, had an unconditional right to personal happiness. See, there was a time where the merchant class was seen as the most parasitic and sick of classes. But these very merchants, once they grew in power, began to imitate the nobles. Even people began to notice that you can have it both ways. If you have enough money, you can have the noble title. You can pretend to be a member of the elite of society and still have this Athenian, what they call the Athenian pagan debauched mentality. Russia was dying. People like Alexander III, Nicholas II, in and of themselves were not sufficient. The bureaucracy had went to the left, and 100 years ago, 1917, when the Tsar abdicated, the Orthodox Church went along with it, and overwhelmingly, the man, with very few exceptions, by the way, accepted the rule of the provisional government. The results of the Petrine Church, you know, something I want to say to the Russian nationalists right now, you have a problem with Sergius's declaration of loyalty to the Reds. Well, I want to hear you also condemn the Synod's full acceptance of the provisional government in 1918, which, by the way, they did offer. They said the same things about the provisional governments that the and Kerensky and the Masonic New Order that had come in, Kerensky was a high-level Mason, that Sergius did to the Reds. The bishops, always living in fear, totally dependent, and now on state salaries, and having been for a long time, the church could not own property at the time. They owned 0% of the land. Was fully supportive of the Tsar's abdication, with one or two voices condemning it, and they loudly and very quickly raised their voices in favor of the provisional government. This is a result, of course, of how these ideologies were penetrating Russian life, how the merchant classes were making money, the sine qua non of civilized life. If it wasn't for the old believers, and especially the old believer merchants, who had certainly a very strong profit motive, but that profit went right back into the community again. Ostentation was out of the question with them. That was the only place where real Russia could be found. This is why Russia died. The U.S. West is long dead. You know, this is just, we're waiting for the end to come. It's been dead for a long time. It's a corpse. You can't do anything about it. However, Russia at the time was dying. And there was very little that anyone could do. John of Kronstadt, Thief on the Recluse, you had great writers. You had tremendous revivals in different areas in Russian life, but they could not compete with Mammon. They couldn't compete with Belial. They couldn't compete with the Athenian Vespers, standing in church for 9 hours, or having a virgin having an orgy with 20 hot chicks. You know, I mean, it's really heroic to pick the former over the latter, but that's exactly what the regime was offering the Russian youth at the time. Dostoevsky's Arkady Dolgorky in A Raw Youth is a way to really demock this and to see the destructive nature of this ideology. So I've gone over my time here. I apologize for that. I've gotten into maybe 5% of what I've been writing on the concept of the sexual revolution in Russia prior to the Bolshevik Revolution or the White Revolution. But we will continue this some other time. I thank you for listening, and I'll talk to you next time. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to The Orthodox Nationalist with Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson at RadioArian.com.